Hello and welcome to Season 1, Episode 6 of the In The Bin Rugby Pod. I'm Andy Wenborn and we have another packed show for you this week. In the news we talk Pollocks, well, Alison Pollock and her latest attempt to ban tackling in schools rugby. Then we turn our attention to the final furlong of the 2023 Rugby World Cup bidding. Will it be Guinness, Champagne or Castle Lager being toasted when the final decision is made? In the Premiership, the Falcons soar to top spot before the Saints ascend above them. Tigers appear to have fully woken from their summer slumber by downing the Chiefs, and Bath swat Wasps aside at the Rico. In the Pro 14, Zebra charge past Ulster, and Glasgow's perfect start continues while the Cheetahs take a bite out of the Ospreys in South Africa. We'll look at the Rugby Championship, where New Zealand continue to be good at rugby and clinch the title, while South Africa and Australia can't be separated again, not even by a hair's breadth. And as always, we'll bring you our tries of the week, hits of the week, and bin juice. And I'm joined by my co-host, Paddy O'Donoghue.
Hello, good evening.
So, you've had a nice weekend away in the Emerald Isle, sir.
Yeah, I went over to see some of the in-laws in Leash before having a cheeky visit to Limerick on Saturday for a stag do with 24 farmers from Galway, which meant there was as much alcohol consumed as I'm sure you would assume from that gathering. But it was a lot of fun, but definitely feeling the effects now. So I'm not as young as I used to be.
So, and some Munster men in the party?
There actually weren't. They were all, I think that every single one of them was from Galway, basically, all these farmers. So we just decided to go to Limerick. So it's a good night out. But there were plenty of good Munster men in Limerick anyway, especially as we were out the night of the Munster game against Cardiff. So there were loads knocking about.
Excellent. Right. Well, we will get on to the Pro 14 in part three, but we'll start part one with the news. And we recorded our show last Monday and didn't really get round to this as it sort of broke that day. So there's been a lot said about what Professor Alison Pollock has had to say. For what seems to be a recurring theme for her every year, I found what was one of her original articles, which was published in 2014, about her want to ban tackling in schools rugby. And I struggle with this because I think she's a very well-respected researcher by all accounts. She's a public health employee. She obviously does a lot of research for her job. But this seems more personal, given that it was brought on by her son, ending up in hospital with a fractured cheekbone caused by being hit during rugby by a knee to the face. And apparently he had already suffered a broken leg and he'd bitten, what was his other injury? He'd had a broken nose when he was 8 years old as well. So I feel that this is sort of heart ruling head in this situation. And I think by bringing it up every year, she's sort of making not a fool of herself. That's a bit of the wrong thing to say, but she's banging a drum that I don't think she's ever going to win this argument.
I think she's certainly losing a bit of credibility with each time it happens. There's usually a fairly strong reaction to when she comes out and says this stuff. And it's sort of now turned into kind of people rolling their eyes and just being like, it's Alison Pollock again, with new research in inverted commas. You know, I don't really think there's anything we haven't seen before. And as you say, it seems like this is very much being pushed by her own agenda due to the injuries that her son had. And I mean, I think that the cheekbone one sounds pretty nasty. I think it just seems like a really unfortunate series of injuries that her son got. I mean, I've definitely had a broken nose or two from playing rugby. I'm not sure if you have as well, Andy, but, you know, some of these injuries aren't necessarily indicative of playing rugby. They're injuries that can happen in, you know, a wide variety of sports. And I do certainly feel that it is just this her own agenda that she's pushing. And there's not necessarily much new information coming to light to support her claims. In fact, it seems more the opposite, because it's, you know, the British Medical Journal, their own research says injuries in rugby are comparable to other sports when you look at people playing at school age. And it just seems incredibly frustrating that she's come back with it again.
Well, and I listened to Brian Moore talk about this, and he's a much more learned man than I in the art of sort of arguing as a you know, ex-lawyer. And he was talking about the research and how actually she hasn't really gone through properly the right sort of evidence bases, and she's just sort of almost handpicked her evidence slightly. And then I saw a nice article tweeted out from the British Journal of Sports Medicine, and they were saying that There is little evidence to suggest that rugby union exposes youths to risks that are any greater than those involved in a range of team sports. The available evidence suggests that physical development and the nature of the sport, including tackle type, change after adolescence, may augment the risk of injury. This risk is strongly linked to poor technique, and it may be disingenuous to deny young rugby players the opportunity to be exposed to the sport. Basically, it's what I would have sort of suggested anyway, in that young people get injured doing lots of things, you know. I ended up in hospital with a broken thumb playing rugby. My sister ended up in hospital turning her ankle, falling over the curb. You know, it's not a comparable thing, but young people get injured doing lots of things. And it's more about technique, and it's more about making sure that children are taught properly. I mean, I'm sure you remember that I do. When you're sort of 12, you're on your knees and people are running at you and you're grabbing their legs and you're making sure you put your head on the right side so they fall the right way. And it's all about teaching technique. And then equally, it's about making sure, I think, there's something to be done about putting people in the right weight class. And then I did listen to Ben Kay and Martin Bayfield talking about this, and they were saying there is a limit to that, though. Just because someone's 12 and say they're 14, 15 stone, or, you know, and someone 12 is 6 stone, yes, perhaps they shouldn't be going together. But to put a 12-year-old then with comparable people of, say, 15 is wrong, because those 15-year-olds of his weight will be just stronger, they'll have played the game longer, they'll just be more canny, and that player will just end up probably being hurt even more by going up to his weight. So I think there needs to be perhaps a little bit of thought around it, but just banning tackling and scrumming in school just seems like a nonsense to me.
Yeah, I just feel like it is a nonsense, and it's just going backwards. I mean, I know she's got her own agenda, as we've discussed, for pushing it, but, you know, it also seems indicative of this cotton wool society we seem to be heading towards, where, you know, so many parents or people just don't want kids doing anything for the risk of getting injured. You know, kids need to be kids, and they need to get out there, and sometimes accidents are going to happen, and they're going to happen doing in all manner of things. But to start taking contact out of rugby, you say it's not even just that element of it, it is then actually incredibly dangerous for people once they start to get to an age of 16, 17, 18, when their bodies are developing. They're going to be much bigger, much stronger, and then they don't have the technique because they haven't learned it. Can you think of the number of injuries that we'd be getting related to it then, considering poor technique is actually the biggest reason for getting that type of injury? It would just be absolutely ridiculous. It'd be catastrophic. And I am just sick of it. And there just seems to be so many people, even in the medical profession, that are coming out with things that either contradict her or just don't support her claims. Now, it wasn't just the British Medical Journal. You've got, you know, another professor, Tara Spears-Jones. I think she's deputy director of the Center for Discovery Brain Sciences. Now, that's a pretty specific field to do with brain science. And she just says that the science is inconclusive at the moment. And then you've got people that are coming up with the wider issues about this. I know a lot of people have said it, including experts in brain injuries, saying that, look, you know, there is going to be some detrimental impact to people if they're at risk of concussion. But actually, that isn't really the big issue. It's obesity and a lack of exercise. And we don't want to be driving kids away from that. There's just so much information out there and evidence that just don't support our claims. And I just think people should stop giving her the time and the platform to be able to start spouting her rhetoric again.
I agree. I think, you know, and it always comes out, and she's very clever with it. She brings it up about September time. Schools are going back. Obviously, kids will be starting PE again. And she wants to get inside parents' heads so that when they send their kids back, they're going to go to the school and they're going to go, I don't want little Johnny playing rugby. Don't put Johnny in rugby class. And then that movement starts again, and she might get a couple of hundred more parents who are going to join. And if she keeps doing it every September, eventually people are going to get bored of her and tell her to go away, because you just can't keep, like I say, sprouting the same stuff with no evidence base. And like, there's no neurologists have come out and backed her up. There's no neuroscientists I'm aware of that have come out and backed her up. And I think she just needs to say, my son got injured and I don't want my son to play rugby, but you can't ban it completely. And especially with the extra impetus on stopping concussion at the moment, even in the professional game, I think it's different. I mean, when we played at school sort of 15, 16 years ago, if we got a bang to the head and were sort of a little bit woozy, you'd throw some water on and we'd probably still have continued. It would never happen now.
The magic sponge solved everything apart from broken bones.
Exactly. But I think we would be taken off, whereas, you know, like I say, previously you might not have been. So the concussion element is being more and more looked at in all sports. Even football are taking it in now. You know, a few years ago, goalkeepers got hit on the head and they got sent back on. Now there's just a full no risk policy. Anyone who's had a head injury who looks a bit woozy is off. And it's taken a while to get there, but I just think she needs to let things take their natural course. And no one is going out to harm children. Okay, there's no evidence that people. Yeah, we're just going to throw children into some sort of unstructured mass brawl with a rugby ball in the middle of it in a school field. I just think she's got the wrong idea about what goes on in schools rugby.
Oh, I think she absolutely does. I'm just so frustrated that it's coming out again.
Right.
Completely enough of her, mate.
We will move on, and we will move on to something a bit more lively and a bit more upbeat. The World Cup 2023 bidding process took a turn this week, and I think everyone turned up to do their final presentations and getting themselves going. I saw a lot of Brian O'Driscoll walking around looking very pleased with himself in a suit. And it's Ireland, France and South Africa. Now, I'm quite surprised that France are on the shortlist personally, considering they only had it in 2007, not that long ago. South Africa, I can see it's been 1995. It's been a long time since they had it. And actually, I'm quite pleased that Ireland are on there, because I think they were always deemed as not perhaps having the necessary stadia, the big enough amount of stadia to be able to do it. But the government are putting a hell of a lot of money into this. I've heard sort of 200 million, 300 million sort of spouted about in different reports I've read to raise the infrastructure and get the stadiums up to scratch. And they would probably be my personal favourites, but I don't think I'd complain if I went to South Africa. But I personally would like to see France wait a little bit, having had it so recently.
Yeah, I'd agree. I mean, Ireland are certainly who I would like to get picked for it, for many reasons, but also, you know, they've just not had it before. France, you know, they can't even get their bid supported by their own president, so they don't exactly look thrilled at the prospect of it. But yeah, Ireland have put in a lot of money to getting a lot of stadiums up to scratch. They're not stadiums that, you know, we've seen with things like the World Cup in football in South Africa. They build a lot of stadiums, they put money into them, and then they just go to complete waste afterwards once this big event's gone. But in Ireland, you're going to be having stadiums that are either existing rugby stadiums, which are already in great nick, or you've got some of the Gaelic sports stadiums, which some of them really could have done with a bit of renovation. But, you know, Irish sports are absolutely enormous over there. So, you know, these aren't stadiums that are going to go to waste. And we all know what kind of reception people get when they go to Ireland for any kind of event. I'm sure it would be absolutely fantastic. So, you know, I really would love to see it there.
Yeah, because they're going to be, I mean, I'm assuming they're going to use Croke Park. The Kingspan up in Ulster will get used. Toman Park. Is the RDS being upgraded for that?
Or... I'm not sure if it's being upgraded, but, you know, it's probably good enough to, as it is, to host maybe some of the pool games anyway.
Oh, here we go. I'm trying to find a list of the stadiums for you, but I'm struggling. But no, I mean, which... do you know which GAA stadiums are going to be used, or are there quite a few that are big enough already? Because, I mean, obviously Croke Park's 80,000 seaters, and I imagine the homes of...
None will be as big as that, and I can't remember.
I don't think they would be as big as that.
Sorry, mate, can't remember.
That's all right, don't worry, just asking. But, I mean, as I was saying, I can't see how France, like you say, without the support of their president, with having had it so soon, and I just don't think that... France needs it again. They're playing on the fact that they're going to make the most money. They're doing what England did for 2015, which is saying, give it to us, we can guarantee 10, 12, 9, 8, however many millions of pounds they want to guarantee to the IRB, and saying, give it to us, we can get all this money. I think the sort of, not the fairy tale, but the sort of heart would like it to go to Ireland, especially that South Africa at the moment, I don't want to say it's not the safest place, but there seems to be a bit more trouble over there than there is all used to be.
Yeah, there does seem to be a bit. I'm just not sure if it's, you know, you just sometimes when you think about these things, and you think, oh, you know, pros and cons for who's going to get it. And then I don't know if it's just probably the cynic in me, but sometimes I wonder, you know, it's not the same as football, but are any of those concerns actually going to make a blind bit of difference when we get to it? Is it just going to be, let's have a look at the money, let's see what's the most we can make out of it, and actually, is anyone really going to consider those concerns? As I said, I know it's not quite the state of FIFA, but I don't really have a lot of faith in some of these tangible things being genuinely weighed up and taken into consideration.
No, and yeah, there's always that risk that the brown you worry about brown envelopes being pushed under desks somewhere, don't you? And it's not necessarily the most open thing. But I think it would take a very cold person not to want Ireland to have it, especially when you think the, you know, Croke Park, 82,000, the Aviva Stadium, 60,000. They're big stadiums. You're going to get big, big crowds in for the final and the semi-finals there. And I've got the list here. Toman Park's 25,000. The Kingspan, Casement Park, which is the, I'm assuming, the home of one of the GAA teams. Perth Stadium in Galway. Fitzgerald Stadium, which is Kerry's home ground, the RDS, McHale Park, Derry. So they're taking it all over the country, Kilkenny. And none of these.
They've got one in Cork as well, actually, Parky Queeve, that's only just recently been finished. They're playing the first games of it in this year's Hurling and Football Championships. And I know that that's been getting highly, highly praised since it's been opened this year as well.
I'm glad you said that, because it's on my list of stadiums I found here. It's a 60 million euro development, which when completed will have 45,000 seats. But it's the name, please say it again for me.
Parky Queeve.
Yeah, it does not look like that when it's written down. It's definitely struggled with that one. I skipped over that one quite quickly. But no, and it'll be nice to get it, because historically, obviously, before they used Croke Park when they were redeveloping the Aviva, the GAA people were very protective of their stadiums, and they didn't want to necessarily let rugby in. So this is obviously quite a big turn up for the books in Ireland in letting all the rugby go to what looks like at least five or six big stadiums.
It'll all be, you know, I don't want to digress too much into the politics of the Gaelic sports, but I mean, it'll all be, you give them a bit of money and eventually they'll open their legs for you. It's the same thing with Sky Sports. They've had a lot of stuff over there. And we see a lot of Gaelic sports on Sky Sports now. And this year was the first time that there were games on Sky Sports that weren't available on Ireland's terrestrial channels. And to say it's caused uproar is an enormous understatement. And they cite money, but they have got so much money in the game for what they need. Unfortunately, it's like the top of many organisations where it's just an element of greed. But, you know, they will get defensive about some stuff. But the thing is, it's happened now. They have used Croke Park not that long ago for rugby. And as I say, you throw a bit of cash their way and you suddenly find that they're a little bit more reasonable.
Like a lot of things in the world of sport, it seems that that's the case. We will draw a line under that with that, and we will move, ending part one, and move swiftly into part two, where are going to round up the Aviva Premiership action from last week. And we're going to start with the big game at Welford Road, where the Tigers took on the Chiefs, coming out 20 points to 13 victors. A game that both of us predicted a bonus point win for the Chiefs, which after their absolute dismantling of Wasps the week before, where they just looked so in control, so accurate with their phase play, regularly putting together 20, 30 phases and just grinding Wasps down. I really couldn't see Leicester matching them, but Leicester were more than worth the win. I thought their defence was outstanding. Their line speed was exceptional. Just really intense, just taking Exeter down early and competing at the breakdown just to try and stop them getting that quick phase play, which has been the hallmark of their game.
Yeah, I think it could have maybe gone a different way had Exeter been able to execute as well as they did last week. You know, I think the first 10-15 minutes of that game, they had a lot of possession and they were going through the phases. But whereas last week they just continued and continued until they scored or won a penalty, it seemed that they were getting into the 22 or getting in and around there. And then there'd be a knock on, there'd be a fumble, they'd give away a penalty. And that just wasn't the case last week. And I think Tigers will certainly have taken a lot of heart from that, and the fact that their defence was up to scratch and they were able to force those turnovers. And, you know, Tigers, once they've got a bit more confidence anyway after, you know, an improvement in results, but with that behind them at home, they really seem to take to that. And I think one of the things we discussed is their forwards. So I don't think they're setting the world alight, but they've improved massively. And we've already seen now that some of the backs that Leicester have got, they seem to be profiting a lot more in broken play because they don't have that concern, and it seems to be coming together for them quite nicely now.
Well, I think what they've done, you talk about the forwards, and like you say, we've been quite scathing of their forwards. They seem to have built a pack again of sort of a bit almost like Newcastle have done, where none of them are particularly big names. I thought Mike Williams was excellent. Callum Afoni's stats are absolutely outrageous. He made 20 tackles this week. And he's also the top tackler in the league so far this season with 80. And he was up there with the carries as well. I think he had close to sort of 15, 16 carries, making a lot of yards. Harry Wells, I'm very impressed with in the second row, and he seems to be forming a nice partnership with Don Barrow, which they were worried when they lost Fitzgerald from that line out for a bit. In Cole and Youngs, you've got two, you know, players who you know are just going to keep going in the front row. And considering Genge went out early, I thought Bateman had a great game. He looked very busy around the park. He seems to carry very nicely. And like you say, once those forwards sort of just get them enough ball, with Tamua now at 12, I think he's doing what Owen Farrell does for George Ford in the England side, and what sort of Mike Catt used to do for Johnny Wilkinson. He's that extra distributor. He takes some of the pressure off. He kicks quite a lot of the ball. He also is absolutely rock solid in defence. Him and Matt Smith seem to not be letting anyone through. Tamua made 10 tackles out of 10, didn't miss any this week. And like you say, that then allows Vianu, who is growing week on week this year, and some of his footwork and just the pace he brings onto the game is absolutely exceptional.
Yeah, he's seriously looking like a player. He seems to have exploded into life in the last couple of weeks, and he just sides through people. Just the pace of attack from him is so dangerous. And it's strange, isn't it? You know, all it takes is a few weeks and suddenly your perspective on teams and players can change dramatically. And all of a sudden, things are looking quite upbeat for Tigers, you say, because it's actually quite a decent blend. You know, their forwards are doing enough to allow the backs to flourish. And they've got people like Tamua, great going forward and in defence. It's allowing Vianu to shine. Everything's just looking a little bit better. You know, obviously, Maloof and May are scoring a lot of tries. Maloof was always going to be a bit of a gamble, but it seems to be like they've got their house in order a little bit. I'm still not convinced that they will necessarily get top four, but they really have sorted themselves out.
Yeah, like you say, Maloof still makes very boneheaded mistakes at times, but he's picking up. And adding to Tamua,
you'd expect to improve, wouldn't you, over the course of the season? These are things, you know, he's been thrown in massively at the deep end, and you would certainly expect him to improve over the season.
But I think that axis of Youngs, Ford and Tamua have all got an excellent kicking game. And I think with that steady Eddie pack they've got, I think that's the sort of game they're going to go down. And with the rain coming down on Saturday at Walford Road in the second half, it really played into their hands where they could just kick for the corners, try and push Exeter back and say, look, if you're going to want to go through 30 phases, by all means do it. But we're going to make you do it from your own 22. And I think that really sort of put a lot of pressure on Exeter that they didn't quite handle. I thought Steenson wasn't at his best. Slade carried a lot of ball and he carried it really well, but he wasn't magical. He wasn't doing any of those clever kicks and putting people through holes that he can do. And it was the sort of stats that came up where at one point, I think Tigers only had 3 visits to the Chiefs 22 and they'd got 17 points. And Chiefs had been in the Tigers 22 8 times and only got 7 points. And that sort of included messing up 3-5 metre lineouts, the sort of things you don't expect from the Chiefs. So I'm not too worried about them. But I just think they had an off day and they ran into a very determined Tigers team.
Well, I think that's kind of hit the nail on the head there. Some of the kind of notes I was making about the game was exactly that. You know, 17 points in 3 visits to Exeter 22 was clinical. And just things weren't clicking for Exeter. Slade wasn't quite on his game. Their driving more wasn't working. Passes weren't quite sticking that were last week. So I don't think, you know, I really don't think there was anything at all for Chiefs to be concerned about. I feel like I've already seen plenty from them this season to suggest they're going to be right up there. I really wouldn't be too concerned about them at all. But Leicester, as I said, things are clicking into gear a little bit. And I think Callum Mahoney, probably a big part of that. You know, he was bought in for his ball carrying and some of his stats for the first few weeks were pretty horrible reading. You know, for someone that was brought in for that purpose, you know, he was carrying the ball, but, you know, I think we were talking about them one week when he'd made about 3 metres the whole game because he's been getting knocked backwards half the time. So, yeah, not a concern for Exeter, but lots of positives for Leicester.
77 metres he made this week, which is much more what you want to see from your number 8.
Exactly.
That's a nice segue. Moving on to our next game, Northampton 30, Harlequins 22. And one thing Northampton aren't struggling with at the moment is back row players who want to make yards. This game, I think, was built on that. They have a big pack. They like to get their pack going forward, getting over the gain line, forcing the opposition to retreat in defence, and then they can unleash their backs, who at times have been more clinical than I thought they'd be. Burrell and Horn seem to be forming an excellent partnership in the centre, and they're bringing in George North, who from somewhere has rediscovered that he's a world-class rugby player. And my find of the season so far, little Tom Collins, who was express acceleration, I think, is what's scary. It's not necessarily the high-end pace, which is obviously very quick, but it's that naught to very quick that he does really quickly to burst through defences, and he's causing lots of teams problems for Northampton.
He's been absolutely electric. He's definitely one of the most exciting players we've seen this season. And he left Marlon Yard for dead for his try. And as you say, it is that acceleration off the mark. He just, before you know it, he's absolutely flying. But just Northampton generally, you know, we're talking about Leicester starting to turn things around, but nothing could be a more stark contrast to Northampton now to the opening weekend of the season. And to be, you know, perfectly honest, I just didn't really think they had it in him. I thought everything was wrong. I didn't see a way out of it for them. But all of a sudden, they look like an absolute nightmare to play against. You wouldn't really fancy playing against them. You know, they've got their forwards going. And Luther Burrell, I think, has been superb, actually, so far. And Malander's really growing into that 10 role as well. And it's a combination of the confidence he's got with his distribution, but also, you know, he made a tackle, might have been on Yard, I think, going back, recovery tackle. Just, you know, to actually have, it's just the opposite of what they were doing the first weekend, where it just looked like they actually couldn't be bothered. You know, he's made so many meters to try and catch up with him, and it was just an absolutely perfect last ditch tackle. And they just, all of a sudden, they just got a really good feel about the club. And, you know, you've got to give them a lot of credit for that. Because I said, I didn't see a way out, but I'd pay entrance money to watch Collins every week.
I think, yeah, oh yeah, he's electric. And I think the other thing that's coming is they've got a bit more consistency in selection than other teams. And I'll move on to my analysis of Quinns in a second, who were savaged by injuries. But being able to pick Groom and Malander at scrum half fly half every week seems to be, they've got a nice connection. I'm not convinced by Malander at fly half. I think now Myler's back, he may well get the gig more regularly. And I'm more convinced that Malander's going to end up in the centres. But with Burrell and Horn playing so well, he might have to wait his turn. And then Collins and North on the wings, and Tuala, who I hadn't really seen much of until this week at fullback, looks a very good find, very steady under the high ball, made some lovely breaks. And that consistency is in stark contrast to what Quinns had, where all of a sudden they're without Robshaw, without Marler, without Horwell, and without Brown, who are four of their big, big leaders. I mean, four of their players that everyone looks to as, you know, quick get us up, boys, gears up, let's get going. And they weren't there. And I think it showed that on another day with those players in the side, this game, I mean, although we've praised Northampton, they didn't run away from Saints, you know, no. They didn't run away from Quinns. You know, it was only 8 points in it, and right at the end, they did have a chance to get a losing bonus point, but they're second row was one of the stupid, we'll get onto that, that's might be in bin, yeah. Might be in bin juice later, but we'll get onto that. But the stats for me that were telling was, if you look at the back rows, Courtney Laws carried for 32 yards, Gibson for 23, and Harrison for 26 in the Saints back row. The Quinns back row carried for Lemua at 8, 15, Clifford 13, Glynn 7. There's just big contrast in getting people going, getting over the gain line, getting the ball moving. And that's where Quinns get all of their play from. And I think Northampton get all their play from. And Quinns just didn't have that and looked a little bit static and lost and looking for sort of a bit of magic from Kerr or Smith to try and get everything going.
Yeah, they can't rely on that. But I do feel a bit sorry for them there. You know, there's a lot of teams with many injuries, but Quinns, you know, seem to be one of the worst affected. And even if you're looking at their props, and I've already said Marler's out, but then, you know, Collier went out, I think with a back spasm or something similar just before the game. And it's really hard to function at your best when you're losing that many players, but that many key players and players of quality. And I do feel a bit sorry for them. You know, so they did have a chance to actually nick a losing bonus point at the end, but they have been savaged. And I feel with the performances they've had, where they're sitting in the table at the moment, it's a little bit unfair on them. But unless they start getting some of these players back, they're probably going to have a few more results like this, especially on the road.
Yeah, and it's not just that they're missing little, you know, not bit part players, they're missing their leaders, their big internationals. Horwell, Robshaw in the pack, we said before the season, are the two players that people look to and are going to, you know, lead from the front and drive everyone on. And then Brown at fullback is the man in that, you know, he spots everything. His attitude and his sort of anger and his presence is everyone feeds off to get them going if they're in a bit of a slump. And you can imagine if they went a couple of tries down like they did here, he would be the first one in the huddle giving it Mr. Angry, you know, eyeballs popping out of his head, getting everybody G'd up. And they're gonna miss that attitude while he's out.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, do you want to touch on what you thought of Sinclair's wandering hands.
Yeah, let's. I mean, first of all, gouges just wrong. Anyone doing them deserves to be banned. I don't understand why people do it. It's just horrible. But I looking at the video, I'm just not sure if there's enough there to confirm he's done it. It's really tricky, and I feel like it can be a bit of a lottery sometimes, particularly with something like a gouge. I have a feeling they might go for one of the entry levels for the lesser offence instead of, you know, kind of, I think it's making contact with the area, or instead of actually making contact with the eye or eye area. And that carries a much more lenient sentence. But I just, from what I've seen, I'm not saying he definitely hasn't or he has, but I just don't think there's anything conclusive from the video I've seen anyway to actually say he definitely has put his fingers in there.
Yeah, his hand was in and around the face. And I think the bit that made it look bad for me was that he's got the scrum hat in his hand. So he's already ripped that off for some reason. No idea why he was trying to rip someone's scrum hat off. And then his hand comes back onto the face again. There's no need for him to go back towards the face. Now, whether he curled his fingers around, whether there was a grabbing motion or a sort of, you know, scratchy type motion, you can't tell. But the fact he puts his hand on the face again and in and around the eyes, I think he's definitely going to get something. And like you say, I think it might well be the entry level, unless someone's popped up with some more evidence or the referee says he's seen a mark on the guy's face. But I imagine he's going to be having a nice little rest for a few weeks.
Yeah, I mean, they seem to take into account any statements from the player who was allegedly gouged. And from what I've read, he was extremely unhappy. Again, I'm not sure if that's right. I'm not saying that you shouldn't trust people, but it seems a little bit silly to start taking people's words for it in something as serious as this. But if they do take into account his statement, from what I've seen, how he felt about it already, we could certainly be looking at a bit of a ban, yeah.
Right, let's move on to Sunday's game, which I was really excited about. Wasps at home. I'd been out for the day, got back in time for kickoff. I was like, excellent, sit down, this is going to be brilliant. The missus was busy. And then I don't think a game of rugby ever actually broke out at the Ricoh Arena on Sunday afternoon. It was stodgy. It was not fluid at all. There was mistakes galore. And Bath did what they had to do. They did sort of almost what Quins did to Wasps, which was frustrate them, not give them the ball. And Wasps, I think, are starting to miss all the players that are injured. They've just got no fluency. They seem to not be able to get the backs clicking. And partly that's due to the fact that they don't seem to be able to get the sort of ball that they want, the fast, quick ruck ball to get the backs going on the front foot to play their nice set moves. And Bath just took advantage of that. They tackled them into the ground. They made 114 tackles more than Wasps did. They only had 37% of the play, but at no point during that game did I ever think, oh, Wasps are actually going to win this.
Did Sam Underhill make 100 tackles?
Well,
have you got that?
No, I've got the stats, and I'm going to sit here with the smuggest look on my face, because for the past 2 weeks I've said, I don't understand what Bath are doing with their back row at times. They've got the England under 20 captain there who has been playing out of his skin. Why is he not getting a game? He promptly gets a game. Not only did he make as many tackles as Underhill, they both made 22, which is way more than anybody else. He only missed one. Underhill missed four. Not that that's necessarily an indictment. And he also got man of the match. And I thought what he bought in his carrying play was fantastic. He's not stocky, big sort of carrier. You're sort of James Haskell-esque style, you know, battering ram. He's a bit more Toby Faletau, a bit more Kieran Reid, sort of goes off. Not as good as Kieran Reid. I said in style. No one's Kieran Reid.
I know what you're saying.
No one's Kieran Reid. But he sort of goes for soft shoulders, and he's always got his arm free to look for the offload. And there was a couple of times where if someone had been running off his shoulder, the offload was on. And I think if Bath players start to learn to play with him a little bit more, and he starts to get a run of games, he could well be, he's definitely one to watch for the future. And if he doesn't start to get games at Bath because of Underhill and Lowe and Garvey and Faletau, if I was him, I'd be pushing for a move, because he did not look out of place playing in a Premiership game, and he's going to want to start getting regular first team action.
Well, the amount of injuries everyone's got, he probably won't have a problem getting some game time, but he certainly did look very, very good. I just think that one of the biggest things for this game is probably injuries again for Wasps. They do look like they're struggling, particularly up front. And it was a really turgid affair, wasn't it? You know, you'd be hoping for a lot more from Wasps, particularly at Wasps. But when you've got someone like Cipriani in particular injured, I mean, even if we just take him on his own, in a game that needs a bit of a spark or is a bit of an arm wrestle and there's not much going on, he loves it. And that's the kind of player you want in for a bit of magic, to be able to put a kick over the top or delay a pass just enough for someone to get through. You know, it's kind of tailor-made for Cipriani to stamp his authority on, really. But when you're missing him, Hughes goes off, and then, you know, back rowers, you know, Reed is out, Thompson's out, Joe Simpson's good nine, but he's not in the form that Dan Robson's been in for the last 12 months. And even someone like Carl Eastman, who I rate quite a lot, and, you know, he's missing from the game as well. It's just, I just feel like there's just so many injuries going on at the moment that we're inevitably going to get some teams that are going to be really up and down. So I don't think it's as bad as some people are making out for Wasps. They don't look the force they did last season. But if they can get a few players back, they will certainly be looking a lot better.
Yeah, I mean, I was playing, I was playing Wasp player bingo then, because I've got a little list of their players injured, and you nearly got House. Tommy Taylor's injured, you didn't say. Willie LaRue's not there. Matt Mullen, James Gaskell. They've got Love Above Alu. Well said. Is injured as well, and I think that is what they're missing. They do, like you say, they
it's
just
almost the whole team, and it's a lot of people that would start for Wasps as well.
Oh yeah, they just lacked fluency, and Haskell went off at 60 minutes, which I was surprised at, and he looked absolutely shattered. So I think he's definitely nowhere near his full fitness again. And I, like you say, it's just going to take a while. I don't think they're going to be the team they were last year. And I think people are expecting them to be running try bonus points in at home all the time, battering teams and just going away from them. That's not going to be Wasps this year. I think they're going to be a lot closer to the pack. I think actually, and the pack have caught up to them a little bit. When you think of teams like Newcastle and Saints, have obviously got better this year. So where Wasps might have gone to Saints and smashed them last year because Saints were in a bit of disarray, they're going to find it a lot harder. And I don't think they're going to be, I probably they might still make the top four, but there really is going to have to be a pickup of form, and they're going to have to get some of their injured players back before I'm thinking, oh, Wasps are definitely in the top three again.
Yeah, I agree. I think they're definitely going to need players to get back quickly if they're going to get top four. Actually, I really wouldn't be surprised to see them miss out if they don't get some of these players back. It really, considering it was their 150th anniversary celebrations, it wasn't the game or the result that they wanted, really, was it? It was a bit of a nightmare on all accounts for that.
Oh yeah, and just touching on players who I thought were good. I thought Launchby looked better because last week we weren't quite sure if he was back. But again, I'd agree with what you said last week. Having seen a full game of Jonathan Joseph, he didn't do anything to make me think that he deserves to be the England number 13 at the moment.
No, he's definitely got more work to do. Obviously, we're always going to see better and worse games from people throughout the season. I think Launchbury may have tackled himself into form last week, just from sheer volume against Exeter. That might have just been the kickstart he needed. But Jonathan Joseph, I don't know what's quite missing at the moment, but it has actually been throughout the course of this season so far. He hasn't been setting the world alight regularly. You know, I know he scored that one try, but that was also in a game where his defence let him down when he's usually so solid. So he definitely needs to pick things up. But I don't think Eddie Jones will be overly concerned given the wealth of options he's got in the centres at the moment.
No, he won't be disappointed at all. And again, nice segue there, moving on to Eddie Jones's options. I'm going to move on to our next game and touch briefly on the Falcons versus London Irish game from Friday night, where I thought a couple of the Falcons pack really put their hand up as saying, you know, why aren't we sort of getting more of a mention in Eddie Jones's thoughts? Because their back row looked exceptional to me. They held Irish out. Irish were spirited for sort of 25 minutes. We'd said last week Irish need to start games better. They were getting blown away in the first sort of 15, 20 minutes. And actually, for the first 20-odd minutes, it was pretty even, actually. And Irish had most of the play, and Newcastle had to tackle themselves to a standstill almost. And then Irish did what they've done on quite a few occasions this season, which is just fall asleep for 8, 10 minutes. Newcastle scored 3 converted tries, and that was it. The game was absolutely out of reach for them. And I don't know where to go for Irish, really. I'm starting to struggle that I think they're lucky that Worcester have been worse.
Yeah, they are. And it is what you're saying. It's switching off, and they need to play for 80 minutes, because through periods in almost every game, they haven't looked out of place at all, and they've been competing. They've been shown up a couple of times by not being clinical enough. But it's their defence that's concerning me a little bit when they do switch off, because from something that I thought was looking really solid in the first game, we've seen gaps that are just so big between players in recent weeks that it's just not acceptable. People just need to be standing in the right place and be making sure they're lining up against opposite numbers. And it sounds so simple, and they're just not doing it at the moment. And they're the things I need to focus on, really, is making sure that they're switched on for a full 80 minutes. And just making sure that they're standing in the right bloody place when they're defending, because they do have flashes in almost every game where they show that they've got, you know, enough quality. They've scored some really nice tries, and that's, you know, against some quite tough defences. But I am getting a little bit concerned. But yeah, Worcester are doing them a lot of favours at the moment. Just need to hope that they don't pick up a couple of wins at Six Ways, because, you know, they could be in trouble. But yeah, they're definitely benefiting from being ever so slightly better than Worcester.
Yeah, I mean, touching on what you said about the defence, my notes I've written while watching the game was for the first try for Newcastle, Citino's run, just put off line out, 10 to 12, 12 scores, too easy. You can't. It was a crash ball for 12, and he's picked a line, and he's gone straight between the centres, who I don't know what the communication was. It was obviously wrong, and he's just run in, and that is. I mean, I wouldn't expect that if I went down the park to watch my local team.
It was the same last week, wasn't it? I'm pretty sure we were saying about one or two of the tries last week too easy, and you just can't get away with that.
Although to be fair, Gonova's first try, where it was a lovely break from Takalua down the right, and he drew the man for a nice offload there. I mean, Newcastle do score some very nice tries, and like I said at the start of this, I just want to give a bit of praise to their back row. So far this season, in the top six tackles in the whole of the Premiership, you've got three Falcons. You've got Welsh and Wilson, their flankers, and Callum Green, their second row. And Will Welsh, their captain, is third on the list for most turnovers this season. And he never gets a mention for the England squad. And I think that's a bit harsh, because they've got a lot of... I think people just think they're journeyman-type players, but they're not. They're very good players. They're very good at what they do. They might not be flashy, but I think now that Dean Richards has had his vision and he's built it for a couple of years, those journeyman players are now being complemented by a couple of flashy players, your Gonivers, your Cicinos, all of these sort of players, and it's actually coming together quite nicely. And I'm really thinking that if they keep this up, they're looking very good for a top four spot, the Falcons.
Yeah, I'll let you get away with Cicinos, as there are actually two of them.
There are, yeah. But his brother's very good.
Gonivers, no.
No. Well, he's probably got brothers.
That's weak. It's a decent effort, but I'm not letting you have it. I do think that, I know this is something that we hear from Northern teams every now and then, that they don't feel that their players get the recognition they deserve when they're in form, and previous England managers don't go and watch enough games, and there's very much a focus on the teams that are from the Midlands down. And when you look at some of the performances from Newcastle, you can start to think at the moment, actually, there might be a little bit of truth in that, because why aren't these players getting a bit more recognition? And it's not even like I'm really hearing them spoken about in that way. You know, it's always easier to focus, I think, on backs, because they catch the eye more. But there's been a few breakout players already this season. I don't really hear as much chatter about Newcastle's players. And, you know, they're sitting... I think they're off the table on points difference, but they're basically sitting on top of the table at the moment. And they've had some really statement wins, you know, away from home. We spoke about their win against Sale. And, you know, yeah, that wasn't a great game, but look at what Sale have done to other sides at home already this season. Just tearing teams apart. And Newcastle just look absolutely fantastic. And they've got quality all over the park. And as we've discussed about their pack in particular, just seems brilliant. And I think it is about time that people started talking them up a little bit more.
Yeah, I think the problem their second rows have got is that England's second row is so good at the moment. There are so many top-class players that are performing at a very high level, they're going to struggle. But I think in the back row, we've been chatting about the fact that, you know, Robshaw's getting older, no one's quite sure what to do with Haskell at the moment, and someone like Welsh or Wilson should definitely be having his name mentioned, especially when you think that the Curry brothers at Sale are getting mentioned very highly. And I know they're younger, yep, and I know they're coming through, and these guys are older, but just because they're young shouldn't mean that they get stepped over, they go over someone who's actually playing better than them.
Yeah, could I just say I know exactly what to do with Haskell, and it's not put him in the side.
No, I know he's
just get rid of him. But yeah, I mean, it could well be that they're just unlucky in the fact that there are lots of talented players. That when you've got people like the Curry brothers, Sam Simmons at Exeter coming through, that if you're looking towards a World Cup in 2019 and beyond that, actually, it maybe makes sense for the coach just to look at them when you've got that many options available to you. It's kind of future-proofing in a way. It's giving people with the potential to get even better that chance. And it may just be, yeah, completely unlucky on their part that the time has just not quite worked for them.
Right, let's move on to the other Northern side, who we've briefly touched on. And we'll gloss over this game slightly. I don't think it needs too much of a chat. But Sale 57, Gloucester 10. Two things. No one saw that coming. That was an absolute hounding that they gave Gloucester. And how can you give away three interception tries in one game? No, you can't be that bad. I mean, it was...
I did write Interception City down when I was watching.
And the problem is I was looking at it because obviously this one wasn't on the telly, so I only got sort of the extended highlights. And the extended highlights were basically Sale running in tries. So I was like, Sale must have had a really good game. They must have had all the play. No. Gloucester had 64% of the ball and 67% of the territory, and Sale made 119 more tackles. Gloucester only had to make 110 tackles. They basically gave the game to Sale with their interceptions. And I don't, like I say, without seeing the game, all of it minute by minute, it just seems like they just didn't have any idea how to break Sale down, and Sale were just clinical when they got the ball.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't see 57-10 coming, but I did see very convincing bonus point win for Sale. And it's almost boring talking about Gloucester like this because it's just the same. And it's not just this season. It seems like every season. What a performance on the opening night of the season. And we're just seeing their inconsistencies again. You know, they win last week at home, they lose now away. And it must be so frustrating for Ackerman watching from the stands, because it's not just Gloucester have gone out there, turned up, put in a real shift and a good performance, and then been undone by a better side in Sale on the day at home. Interceptions all over the place. There was some really, really sloppy play. And some of those interceptions, it wasn't a brilliant bit of opportunism, particularly the 12 trees one, just tossed it up. And I was just watching it thinking, what are you thinking? There were a few of them actually in different games this week, thrown up passes for interceptions. But I just don't understand what is going through the Gloucester players' heads, because they are just completely different from one week to the next. And as I say, if they had gone up there and played well, you could maybe think, well, that's fine. But the performances are hugely, hugely worrying. And how on earth you drum consistency into that side, I really don't know.
I think Ackerman's going to be earning his pennies. He's got a lot of work to do. On Sale, I said before the season, I like the look of their back row, and I think it's coming on really nicely. Strauss had a great game, very good stats. Either of the Curries, they played Ben this week. I think Tom was on the bench. They seem to change them at seven. He's going to give you an engine all day and make his tackles. And then John O'Ross has slipped in nicely as your workhorse number six. And that is going to give them a lot of good ball and also slow the opposition down. And then De Klerk at nine, I think, has been my favourite signing of the season so far. He just looks...
Faf de Klerk was brilliant. Again, I know Gloucester weren't up to much, but Faf de Klerk was superb at the weekend.
How he's not away with South Africa at the moment is beyond me. I mean, Worcester are really missing Huard, and Sale are definitely gaining from having De Klerk in there.
Absolutely, yeah. He's been a key player for them. And he just oozes class, doesn't he? He just makes them tick. He makes things happen. And yeah, you know, it is actually a bit of a surprise that South Africa haven't just nicked him away for a bit.
Yeah. Well, talking about Huard, we'll, again, this one really doesn't take much chatting about. Saracens went to Worcester and won. Shock horror. Despite all their injuries, no Vunipola, no Berger, no Rhodes. Brits left at the start of the game because he didn't quite make it and got ill. 25-3. The only thing that they were disappointed about is that they didn't get the bonus point, but I think it was probably a very convincing win for them, where they perhaps just a bit scrappier than they usually were, weren't quite as accurate and missed the chance for the bonus point, but they'll go home and go, yep, 4 points is 4 points. Thank you very much.
Yeah, but I think the only point I've really got to make on it is that this is a couple of games now where Saracens have made a pretty good start, first kind of 20, 30 minutes, and then they've just not capitalised on it to get a big score and make sure they've got the bonus point in the bag. And that's something that we saw them do all the time last season. They just don't seem to be quite firing on all cylinders yet. I mean, it is still relatively early days, particularly when you factor in a lot of the Lions players will have come in later along in the season. But I think, you know, they're really just not quite there yet. And with Europe coming up soon, they're going to want to get themselves sorted, particularly because they'll have far tougher teams than Worcester, and they won't get afforded the luxury of some of the spaces that Worcester gave them, and just they won't get away with not taking those chances.
I think it's the same as what we've said for a lot of the other teams. I think the number of injuries that are occurring is just stopping any momentum and any fluency that teams can build. And although they train together each week and they all know each other and they've probably played before, I think everyone who's ever played the game knows that if you play with the same person for 2 or 3 weeks, you just know the timing of their runs. In the line out, you know when your second row is going to go up. You know that little look he gives, the little bend of the knees he does before he jumps. You know, you can analyze, you know your centre is going to run that line, and or your fullback's going to kick it when this happens. And just not having that fluency is just, I think, causing a lot of teams a lot of problems at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, I know exactly what you're saying. Sometimes there are just little things. I mean, I tend to know by your movements when you're going to the bar. I've got that nailed now, so I'm pretty happy with that.
I'm surprised. It rarely happens. Right, so let's move on for the Premiership. For your try of the week, Mr. O'Donoghue, please.
A few contenders. I did quite like Gonovers, but I'm still fuming that there seemed to be a missed tackle on Takalua, so I'm gonna leave that. That was almost a bit of a tongue twister, actually. I liked Gilsonan's for Irish. I thought Solomona's and McGuigan's were pretty decent, but my favourite is going to be Hayward's for Northampton. I just thought it was a fantastic team try. There was interchange between the forwards and the backs, some lovely offloads cutting through people. Courtney Laws was right up there at the end to take a pass and give it back. I just thought as a team try, I really, really liked that one. So I'm going to give it to Hayward for Northampton.
That's very annoying. you've mentioned all three that I've got written on my piece of paper. I had Hayward as my winner as well. I did like Gonovis, but Hayward was my winner. But if you've given it to him, I would like to give a big shout out for Solomona's after 50 seconds, because it was a nice backs move to get him free down the right wing. To get outside the defence. And that chip was perfect. Obviously, it was a bit lucky to land it about half a foot inside the line and it bounced perfectly into his hands. But you got to take what you can take and then round under the post for the finish. That's great individual skill. And if he can sort his defence out, he's really going to be pushing Eddie O'Sullivan's mind for a place in the England side, because the amount of tries he scores...
Eddie O'Sullivan, have we gone back about 10
Sorry,
years?
Eddie Jones, excuse me. Mate, it's been a long day. Eddie Jones's mind for a place in that England squad, because he can't stop scoring. He was 40 odd tries in the Super League, nearly a top try scorer in the Premiership last season, bagging loads already this season. He's going to be seriously looked at if he can pick up his defence.
Yeah, stays out of trouble as well. But I think also when we've spoken about finishers like Solomona, when we've spoken about Rocco Degouni and Wade, they're at a kind of slight disadvantage defence-wise just because of the size of them anyway. That even if they don't know where their positioning's supposed to be, they're going to get run over a few times. Solomona is a beast of a man. You know, if he can work out his positioning and get stuck in there, I don't think it'll be a problem. And yeah, when he just has the weight of tries he does again and again, he is going to be hard to overlook. So definitely one to watch out for, but also just needs to stay out of trouble and watch his behaviour.
Right, so and moving on, your hit of the week, please.
Mark Lambert running in. I don't even know who it was, into a Northampton player. It was the last play of the game in the Quins game. And he got the ball and he just absolutely devastated the fella in front of him, one of the Northampton backs, and he just went absolutely flying backwards. And I think they won the penalty from that, which they promptly gave away. But Mark Lambert just hit him like a truck, and I just really enjoyed it. So it was a carry, but yeah, the impact he made when he went into him, thoroughly enjoyed it.
They all count. I thought he had a great game, carrying really well. Man, big unit, absolutely huge unit. My hit of the week is going to go to Matt Tamua, whose defence was absolutely outstanding all day for Leicester, but he put in one hit on Jack Yendall. Exeter were doing what they always do, coming around, trying to get the pressure play going, build the phases. And Yendall caught the ball, thought, oh, here's a back I can run into. And Tamua hit him and then drove him backwards. No, he didn't nail him as in sort of hit him and he went straight down. He hit him and then picked him up and took him about 3 or 4 yards backwards and dumped him on his back. And it was just one of those where you just saw all the momentum go out of Exeter. All their players had to shift 5 yards back and it just stopped their play. And you could see Leicester got a real G up out of it. Right, so... Good stuff. Paddy, any bin juice for you this week? What are you putting into the bin juice?
I do have bin juice. Can I do a bit of bin juice now and then come back to something because it's going to come up in something we haven't discussed yet?
Please, by all means.
I'm just getting carried away with the juice. So the bin juice for the Premiership is basically some of the passes that have been thrown. So I think I mentioned it. There was the Billy 12 Trees one, where he just tossed it up, and I was thinking, what on earth are you doing? And there are a couple of others in games. I don't understand. Because Luther Burrell, that was it. Luther Burrell did, I think his was the best/worst of the weekend. When you're running across the line, you've got the ball in hand, and you're thinking about flinging out a wide one. I've seen some of this. How do you not see? There's someone almost there waiting, and you float it up at a 45-degree angle and lob it about 20 metres. And someone just plucks it out. And sometimes I just think take them off for an HIA after they've done that, because I'm not really sure there's any other reasoning as to why they've done it. And players just need to use their head a little bit more, because when I've seen these passes, they're not, you know, big old forwards with tiny pigeon brains that everyone has a go at. These are the backs, the supposed intelligent ones. So that's my bin juice.
Supposed intelligent ones. I'm going to go to one of my old favourite, and it's just the stupidity of players. Merrick, the Quinn's second row, who promptly gave away the penalty they had to get a bonus point at the end, just diving into a ruck with no arms, shoulder charge / elbow just into the head. I mean, we've seen this, that's at least two or three we've had every week so far, and people just don't seem to be learning that you can't go into a ruck like that. You've got to try and get your arm round. You've got to try and drive forward. You can't just dip the shoulder and drive in. When are they going to learn? One of the Argentinians had one. Lavini got sin-binned against New Zealand. Same thing. Drop in the shoulder, just into someone's head. Now, I heard the commentators going off about it on BT saying it's very difficult when they get that low. You've got to try and drive up. Salvi got sent off, basically headbutted Vianu, just like kamikaze dive, like you used to get on Worms, the game, just straight into him. They've got to make more of an effort. The refs are obviously picking up on it. They can't be that thick every week.
Yeah, I will say that I saw the Salvi one, and when there was a lot of defence coming from the commentators, I have to say I didn't really see it. And I just thought, well, no, actually, I'm not really sure there's any excuse for what he's done there. But Merrick's, without doubt, is worse because of the circumstance for the team as well. They've just won a penalty, a kickable penalty that would get them a losing bonus point, and you throw it away. I just think it's outrageous, and someone needs to give him a clip around the ear.
Excellent.
Not me, though. He's too big for that.
No, I'd leave that to someone else. Right, so that is the end of part two, and we will move swiftly into part three, where we go into our Pro 4 team roundup. Now, I hope you're all right in your house there, Paddy. There's no lions knocking about, is there? We don't want any injuries occurring.
Well, the missus can get a little bit rowdy, but yeah, otherwise I'm fairly safe.
Yeah, so as that was the stupidest story of the week, but the best story of the week, moving on the animal theme, has to go to the Zebra, or Zebre, or however you pronounce it. Getting a win against Ulster, absolutely fantastic. No one saw that coming. Ulster, who I'd seen play excellently against the Scarlets a couple of weeks back and looked really crisp, excellent wide play, just never got going. Zebra got into them, scored some fantastic tries, by the way. A couple of their tries were very good. And Ulster never sort of got into the game, and Zebra held out. It's a fantastic result for Italian rugby.
Yeah, well, they've had a couple, haven't they, so far this season. But this is certainly the standout result of the lot, particularly given how well Ulster have been playing in the last couple of weeks. And as you say, they're actually really good value for it. This wasn't a smash and grab where they've only had a few visits and they've just got a bit of luck. They actually really deserved it. And some fantastic tries. There's a break by Minozzi, their fullback. Just absolutely superb stuff. Just so easy on the eye to watch. And they were total value for their win. And I just think that they've been such they've just been getting beaten, haven't they? Just getting hammered. Bonus point loss after bonus point loss for so long now. And I know when we spoke in our season preview, it's, you start to think, well, what's the point? Because there's just no progression. Maybe they were listening as well as Treviso. But as soon as you get those first wins, just the confidence factor that's come into it now, they must be playing with so much more confidence, because some of the offloads and the breaks they made during that, I'm just not convinced that they would have even tried it a few weeks ago. And just got to really hope that they can carry on some of this momentum now. And they're not going to win every week. If we can start seeing some real performances of them and then getting some scalps as well, I just think it's great for not just for Italian rugby, but for rugby all round.
Yeah, and I wonder if Conor O'Shea's been in the ear, because I know he was very, when I've heard him interviewed, he's very up on trying to not just be the Italian national team coach, but trying to broader Italian rugby, trying to get more people involved, trying to grow the game. And I do wonder if he's been in the camps at Zebra, at Treviso, trying to get his message across so that everyone's singing off the same hymn sheet, everyone knows what they're doing, and just trying to build the game gradually. Because Treviso as well have been in games. I mean, they went to unbeaten Glasgow. I mean, I know Glasgow won, but actually, Glasgow
did all right.
Well, there was only, you know, they had to get a couple of late tries. Treviso got back into the game. They got to within 6 points at one point when they had a little sort of mini fight back. And it wasn't the, you know, you expect Glasgow unbeaten at home, scoring tries for fun. They're going to batter them. Treviso won't be in it. Actually, they put up more of a fight. And I do think that Conor O'Shea is perhaps trying to just get into those teams. And we might, it's said every year, I do wonder if he might just get Italy a little bit closer this year in the Six Nations.
We'll see. That's probably the last one. I'm not sure I'm 100% convinced yet, but it will be good to see. But one thing I want to say about Ulster, though, as well, quickly, is that their fly-half, John Cooney, had quite a good game, and I think they'll be quite pleased with that, especially given the Paddy Jackson situation with the allegations against him at the moment. That's a pretty dark cloud kind of hovering over them, and that would have been kind of a big loss for Ulster, because he was one of their star players. Obviously, if the allegations are true, then yeah, he deserves to get everything thrown at him. But it's just from a rugby perspective, losing a player like that can be really tricky in such a pivotal role. And I think they'll be very pleased with how composed John Cooney was in his kicking at the weekend.
Yeah, I saw some of his kicks. He seemed to slot everything. He was very good. The other thing with the Pro 14 that I'm going to add, having watched a lot more of the highlights sort of the last few weeks than perhaps I had done before, standard of rugby in terms of the wide play, a lot of the Premiership, sort of, you see quite a lot of pick and go tries, driving tries quite often. There's a lot of beautiful wide play, a lot of good interchange with the backs, the Scarlets especially, Glasgow try and do it. I saw some good stuff from Munster. The quality of the backs play seems to be very, very high, and I'm wondering if when they get into Europe and the big French packs and the big English packs start to put pressure on them, whether they will be able to recreate that or whether they will crumble and actually they're able to get away with playing like that because of the teams they're playing against, and it's sort of style on style rugby where both teams are trying to play that way, and it sort of creates that sort of nice game.
I think I'd have a decent amount of confidence in a few of the teams that they've proven enough over the last few years that they've got calibre to mix up their game in Europe. But also, and I think it's worth pointing out, that if that is just more the style of play in the Pro 14 compared to the Premiership, they're going to have a lot more players fit for Europe anyway. They're going to have a lot more of their key players available. And, you know, I'm not saying that it's a conspiracy that that's what they do, but it is inevitable that when there is that more open game and it's just less brutal, that they're going to have more better players available when it gets to Europe to be able to decide which way they want to play.
Yeah, and I'm quite pleased that the Cheetahs won again. They're actually putting up quite a nice fight in that division now. They're up to third.
They were playing Ospreys, though, weren't they?
Well, they were playing Ospreys, who aren't very good. That Conference A is looking quite good, because Zebra are in fourth, sitting above Connacht, Ospreys and Cardiff, which I think is brilliant because they've got two wins so far. So that's the other division is sort of as you would expect, with the Southern Kings and Treviso at the bottom. But I quite like the look of that league. I know Glasgow are unbeaten, but it could get a bit tasty if the Cheetahs continue to be difficult to beat in South Africa. And did you see their winger? I can't pronounce his name properly, so I don't know why I'm going to try. Mambapini? Lightning. Absolutely lightning. And he's going to cause a lot of teams a lot of problems. Don't giggle at my pronunciation.
I don't know how to correct it, so I'm not going to. I just appreciated your effort. That was it.
Oh, thank you very much. Now, have you got a try of the week from the Pro 14?
Yes, I do. So I was tempted with Bellini's try, which was the one for Zebra, which was set up by the Minozzi break.
Yep.
And I was also tempted by Von Jarsfeld for the Cheaters, who grabbed a couple, and I think he's already got five this season as a hooker, which is quite impressive. But I'm going for Rory Scannell's for Munster. Sorry, JJ Hanrahan's, but it was mainly set up by Rory Scannell with just a delightful break through the defence. Lovely step. And I've seen a few of them this season, but it's that just the offload. You're wrapped up by a player and it's almost lean round the back of them and catapult the ball as an offload into JJ Hanrahan, who's returned to Munster this season for him to get his first try back at Toman Park. So that's my pick for try of the week.
And I went with one of the ones you mentioned. I went with Bellini's try. It wasn't, I thought it was one of the best tries scored. And I think the situation that it was scored in and the circumstances and for the team it was scored in made it even better. Like you say, the break from the fullback was exceptional. Some lovely interplay, a couple of offloads with the forwards involved and a lovely finish from him. And I think it's, if we can see more tries like that from Zebra this season, it'll be fantastic. So there was also some international rugby played this week. And as I mentioned in the intro, shock horror, New Zealand good at rugby. Who knew? Their 36-10 win over Argentina cemented the Tri-Nation, their rugby championship, which they'd already actually won, given the result earlier in the day. But they went 29-3 up, sort of coasted to the finish. I don't think they ever looked not in control of that game. And when you've got Beauden Barrett throwing through the legs passes for Damian McKenzie to run onto to score, it was just a clinic, really.
It was. Again, you know, you don't want to stop giving people credit just because they're that good. But you almost do stop saying it about New Zealand because you expect it. They do it all the time. You end up saying the same things every week because they just do it every week. But they are just, yeah, they're just a wonder. And I think in particular, Barrett and McKenzie, again, just fantastic to watch. And I could watch Barrett offloading all day, his out of the back of the hand pass again on the way through. And he's got such pace. He is so, so quick. I think my favourite part of the game, though, was McKenzie flying like a bullet for his try. I don't know if you saw it, but he just ran and dived. It just seemed like a flash. It was like Superman had come out of nowhere.
He was so much pace.
Yeah, yeah. But then, you know, this is the flashy stuff we see from New Zealand. Yeah, their scrum was dominant. They had all of those basics in play. And they just beat Argentina all ends up. And that's, you know, it's no criticism of Argentina at all. But you know, it was just dominant scrum, offloads at exactly the right time and plenty of them, just complete express pace, some really, you know, flashy, classy stuff as well. Deservedly won, deservedly unbeaten, and it's a pretty bleak outlook for the other Southern Hemisphere teams that have to play him in the Rugby Championship again.
Yeah, I think it was that dominance at the scrum that took me by surprise. You don't expect Argentina to get beaten at scrum time like that. The one thing they pride themselves on is their ability to scrum, and New Zealand aren't. I think there's a myth that New Zealand can't scrum. I don't quite know where it came from, but their scrum is, they don't see it as a chance to win penalties like a lot of other people do. They see it as a restart to the game. Let's get the ball to the backs. Let's get something going. And they absolutely mauled Argentina in the scrum. Argentina only won 5 of 9 scrums. That's unheard of. Around 55%. New Zealand perfect on their own scrum ball. And if they're going to start getting a dominant scrum to coincide with their absolutely fantastic back play and offloading, it's just may as well just know and not bother with them. Just let them play amongst themselves and we'll all fight over who's second best.
Give up and go home.
Now, onto the other game, like I say, which was played out before the New Zealand game. And actually, the result confirmed New Zealand as champions because yet again, Australia and South Africa couldn't be taken apart. 27-27 once more in a topsy-turvy game. The lead changing hands a number of times. And Israel Folau getting upset with man buns. So it had everything, this game.
It really did. It was just a cracking game to watch. I know there's been a lot of concern about the state of South African rugby and Australian rugby, which we've touched on as well. But just as a game to watch, really, really thought it was a belter. Some really cracking tries in there. As you say, it was lead changing hands as well. Kirtley Beale got completely dismissed when one of the South African flankers ran into him, which I enjoyed a lot. And, you know, people like Foley, I thought, you know, had a good game. He seems to get a lot of flack sometimes, but I always think he's got a touch of class about him when I see him play. But yeah, huge talking point with Folau, which was basically the bit I wanted to lob in bin juice. Just pulling people by the hair is just not acceptable. It just makes you look like a complete moron and an idiot. Nobody likes you. And it was the best and worst of him at times. You know, he scored a really nice try. But it's, you know, I think for a lot of rugby players, it's almost worse than doing what would be perceived as more violent outbursts. You know, you just don't do it. It's just not a done thing. And I think the only thing worse than it was Michael Checker pretending he didn't see it and making a bit of an idiot out of himself. You know, he says he doesn't like to be portrayed as a clown, yet he comes and does an interview like that. Makes me think it was deserved.
There are things that I saw a meme, and it's things that are always known in the world, you know, life, death, taxes, and Michael Checker will whine about something. You know, he's always got something to complain about. I think we'll find out where South Africa and Australia are when it comes to the autumn internationals. We know New Zealand are very good. People get spanked by New Zealand all the time. Where are the Northern Hemisphere teams in relationship to these two? Because the past couple of times, Ireland, Wales, they tend to struggle actually a bit more than the others, but Ireland and England especially have had the upper hand. Scotland went down to Australia in the summer and beat them. So if they all come up north in the autumn and we continue to beat them, I think there will be more questions asked about Australian South African rugby. Them getting beaten by New Zealand, is it they don't like it, and their journalists will write, you know, death throes to their rugby about it. But I think it's actually if they start getting beaten regularly by us lot up north, who they deem sort of slightly inferior and always have done, then they will be seriously, seriously worried.
Yeah, it's kind of weird because you actually kind of find yourself hoping that they have a good series in the Northern Hemisphere in the autumn internationals, because you don't want the outlook to be as bleak as it potentially looks. But it has been different, hasn't it, in the last couple of years, autumn internationals. You say that actually Ireland and England have been given a bit of a going over. Scotland have been getting closer and closer and nicked a couple of wins. And so it's not looking great. And even though New Zealand are going to spank a lot of teams, actually the level of spanking they've given, especially that 57-point win over South Africa, that is a huge, huge concern. But I really hope that they can find something in them to have really decent competition in the games up here. But you know that they don't really like the Northern Hemisphere teams that much. So I'm hoping that we will get some good games.
Indeed. Right. We are pushing already 70 minutes this week. Extended pod for you lovely listeners. And we will move swiftly into part four and our Aviva and Pro 14 predictions, where last week we could hardly be separated in the Premiership. We both got four correct results and two wrong results. We both had Exeter to win. You had Quins to beat Saints, and I had Wasps to beat Bath. We predicted all the games in the Pro 14 correctly, apart from Zebra's shot win at Ulster. And with my excessive bonus point predictions, I took the points in that one, pipping you by 3 points. Let's move on to this week. So first up in the Premiership on Friday night is Quins having Sale travel away from their cosy northwest base. Are they going to be able to beat Quins?
No, I don't think they are. I think Quins do have serious injury problems, as we've discussed, and that's going to make it a slightly different prediction than it would have been otherwise, because I would have thought they'd have got a bonus point win. But still being at the Stoop, bouncing back, and the fact Sale really just aren't the same team when they're away from the AJ Bell, I'm going to go for Quins to win, but no try bonus point for them and no losing bonus point for Sale.
I'm going to slightly disagree. I think Quins will win because, like you say, Sale don't travel well, but I am going to give Sale a losing bonus point. Now, the next game should be quite an easy one. Bath are hosting Worcester at the Rec.
Bath, bonus point win. No bonus point for Worcester.
And I agree with that one. And then I think possibly onto the tastiest encounter of the weekend, or Sunday's game might beg to differ, but Exeter hosting the high-flying Newcastle Falcons.
It's pretty. Newcastle are exception at the moment, but I think particularly coming off a loss and then playing at Sandy Park, I struggle to see anything other than Exeter win. But I don't think they'll get a try bonus point. But I also think they'll win comfortably enough to stop Newcastle from getting a losing one.
Okay, I think Exeter, again, I agree. I think they'll beat Newcastle, but I think Newcastle are scrappy and they will stay in this and they will get the losing bonus point. Now then, this is interesting because Gloucester are at home, so you automatically think Gloucester will win, but they're taking on the Saints, who are unbeaten in their last four games.
I'm going to go for a Northampton win with a Gloucester losing bonus point. No try bonus points.
I think I might have to match you on that one. That was what I was thinking as well. I think, yeah, Saints will have too much and Gloucester look in disarray, but I think at home they're never beaten badly and they will get the losing bonus point. Now, can Irish get their season back up and running against Leicester?
Probably not. I think Leicester are going to have a bit too much for Irish, particularly with their recent resurgence. But I do think Irish will be hell-bent on focusing and playing for 80 minutes, and as a result will nick a losing bonus point. And I don't think we'll see Leicester score four tries.
I'm going to disagree. I think Leicester try bonus point, nothing for Irish. And then the arguably the biggest game of the weekend, I still think it's probably Exeter versus Falcons, but Saracens host Wasps.
I'm going to go for Saracens to win. No losing bonus point for Wasps. And do you know what? I'm going to go for Saracens to just properly heap on the misery and get a try bonus point as well.
That's why I think Wasps look really in disarray. They need some of their players back very, very quickly, or it could be a long end to the season. Right, let's shuffle through these Pro 14 ones very quickly as we move on. The Blues host the Dragons.
Blues win, no bonus points for anyone.
Yeah, I think that might be a very low quality game. The Cheetahs, resurgent at home, unbeaten at home, against the unbeaten Glasgow Warriors travelling to South Africa. Excellent game.
Really tricky game to call. Very, very tricky. I'm going to go for Cheetahs to continue their form. I think there could be bonus points in this all over the shop. I'm going to go for try bonus points for everyone.
And do Glasgow get a losing bonus point?
Yes, they do.
Okay, I am going to go for a Cheetahs. Oh, I don't know. Are you? Oh, I don't know.
It's a tough one, this one. It's really,
yeah,
really.
I think if it was in Glasgow, I'd give it to them. But I'm going to give Cheetahs the win with a bonus point. Glasgow with a losing bonus point. I'm not sure if they'll get the try bonus point. I'll give Glasgow a losing bonus point, though. Edinburgh hosting Zebra.
God, these are really hard. I think Edinburgh are going to take it. I think the fact they're at home and they've had a couple of disappointing results, I think that they will win. I don't think they'll score four tries, but I don't think Zebra will get a losing bonus point.
I'm going to give Zebra a losing bonus point in that one. I'm confident of the Zebras. Ulster hosting Connacht. They will want a reaction.
Yeah, I'd be very surprised if Ulster don't win that. I mean, Connacht actually looked pretty decent at the weekend in their loss, but Ulster are going to be pretty fuming. Back at home, I see an Ulster win. I see a bonus. I see a try bonus points potentially for both, but I'm going to go for Ulster with a try bonus point. That's it. And no losing bonus point for Connacht.
I'm going to give Ulster the win. I'm going to give no bonus points to anybody. Now, big, big Irish derby. Leinster host Munster at the RDS. Or is it? Or it might be at the Viva. You never know. They normally move those.
Yeah, could be moved, but it'll be in Leinster anyway. Munster win. No try bonus points, losing bonus point for Leinster.
Said like a true Munsterman. I'm going to give it, as it's at home, I'm going to give Leinster the win, no bonus points to anybody. No, Munster are losing bonus point. Yeah. Now, Treviso host the Kings, and actually, for once, Treviso are going to be favourites in the
favourites. Don't let me down, Treviso. I am going to go for Treviso win, try bonus point. No losing bonus point for Kings.
I'm going to go for a Treviso win only. And then the lowly Lion-bitten Ospreys are hosting the Scarlets.
Might pick up their game a bit, Welsh Derby, but Scarlets are just too good, I think. And so I'm definitely going to go for a Scarlets win. I'm going to go for a Scarlets bonus point. No losing bonus point for Ospreys.
And I will join you on that. That is all we've got time for this week on the In The Bin Rugby Pod. Thank you for joining us. We are brought to you by lastwordonrugby.com. Please do check out their website for articles, news and reviews. And we will look forward to joining you next week. Say goodbye, Paddy.
See you later.
Bye-bye.